of China. They took off the bandages, and for the first time in 2 decades he saw his wife. Then he opened his mouth and said, "You're so old." Leslie pushed back her shirt sleeve, and as she reached for an olive, I noticed a rubber bracelet on her left wrist. "Is that a watch?" I asked. "No," she told me. "It's a Fitbit. You sync it with your computer, and it tracks your physical activity." I leaned closer, and as she tapped the thickest part of it, a number of glowing dots rose to the surface and danced back and forth. "It's like a pedometer," she continued, "but updated and better. The goal is to take 10,000 steps per day, and once you do, it vibrates." I forked some salami into my mouth. "Hard?" "No," she said, "it's just a tingle." A few weeks later, I bought a Fitbit of my own and discovered what she was talking about. 10,000 steps, I learned, amounts to a little more than 4 miles for someone my size. It sounds like a lot, but you can cover that distance over the course of an average day without even trying, especially if you have stairs in your house and a steady flow of people who regularly knock, wanting you to accept a package or give them directions or just listen patiently as they talk about birds, which happens from time to time when I'm home in West Sussex. One April afternoon, the person at my door hoped to sell me a wooden bench. It was bought, he said, for a client whose garden he was designing. Last week she loved it, but now she's decided to go with something else. In the bright sunlight, the fellow's hair was as orange as a popsicle. The company I ordered it from has a no-return policy, so I'm wondering if maybe you'd like to buy it. He gestured toward an unmarked van idling in front of the house, and seemed angry when I told him that I wasn't interested. "You could at least take a look before making up your mind," he said. I closed the door a couple of inches. "That's okay." Then, because it's an excuse that works for just about everything, I added, "I'm American." "Meaning?" he said. "We stand up a lot," I told him. "Oldest trick in the book," my neighbor, Thelma, said when I told her about what had happened. "That bench was stolen from someone's garden, I guarantee it." This was seconded by the fellow who came to empty our septic tank. "Pikeys," he said. "Come again?" "Tinkers," he said. "Pikeys." "That means gypsies," Thelma explained, adding that the politically correct word is travelers. I was traveling myself when I got my Fitbit, and because the tingle feels so good, not just as a sensation, but also as a mark of accomplishment, I began pacing the airport rather than doing what I normally do, which is sit in the waiting area, wondering which of the many people around me will die first, and of what. I also started taking the stairs instead of the escalator, and avoiding the moving sidewalk. "Every little bit helps," said my old friend Dawn, who frequently eats lunch while hula-hooping and has been known to visit her local Y 3 times a day. She had a Fitbit as well, and swore by it. Others I met weren't quite so taken. These were people who had worn one until the battery died. Then, instead of recharging it, which couldn't be simpler, they'd stuck it in a drawer, most likely with all the other devices they'd lost interest in over the years. To people like Dawn and me, people who were obsessive to begin with, the Fitbit is a digital trainer, perpetually egging us on. During the first few weeks that I had it, I returned to my hotel at the end of the day, and when I discovered that I'd taken a total of, say, 12,000 steps, I'd go out for another 3,000. "But why?" Hugh asked when I told him about it. "Why isn't 12,000 enough?" "Because," I told him, "my Fitbit thinks I can do better." I look back at that time and laugh. 15,000 steps. Ha! That's only about 7 miles. Not bad if you're on a business trip or you're just getting used to a prosthetic leg. In Sussex, though, it's nothing. Our house is situated on the edge of a rolling downland, a perfect position if you like what the English call rambling. I'll follow a trail every now and then, but as a rule I prefer roads, partly because it's harder to get lost on a road, but mainly because I'm afraid of snakes. The only venomous ones in England are adders, and even though they're hardly ubiquitous, I've seen 3 that have been run over by cars. Then I met a woman named Janine who was bitten and had to spend a week in the hospital. "It was completely my own fault," she said. "I shouldn't have been wearing sandals." "It didn't have to strike you," I reminded her. could have just slid away. Janine was the type who'd likely blame herself for getting mugged. "It's what I get for having anything worth taking," she'd probably say. At first, I found her attitude fascinating. Then I got vindictive on her behalf and started carrying a snake killer, or at least something that could be used to grab one by the neck and fling it into the path of an oncoming car. It's a hand-sized claw on a pole. It was originally designed for picking up litter. With it, I can walk, fear snakes a little less, and satisfy my insane need for order all at the same time. I'd been cleaning the roads in my area of Sussex for 3 years, but before the Fitbit, I did it primarily on my bike and with my bare hands. That was fairly effective, but I wound up missing a lot. On foot, nothing escapes my attention. A potato chip bag stuffed into the hollow of a tree, an elderly mitten caught in the embrace of a blackberry bush, a mud-covered matchbook at the bottom of a ditch. Then there's all the obvious stuff, the cans and bottles and great greasy sheets of paper fish and chips comes wrapped in. You can tell where my territory ends and the rest of England begins. It's like going from the rose garden at Sissinghurst to Fukushima after the tsunami. The difference is staggering. Since getting my Fitbit, I've seen all kinds of things I normally wouldn't have come across. Once, it was a toffee-colored cow with 2 feet sticking out of her. I was rambling that afternoon with my friend Maya, and as she ran to inform the farmer, I marched in place, envious of the extra steps she was getting in. Given all the time I've spent in the country, you'd think I might have seen a calf being born, but this was a first for me. The biggest surprise was how nonplussed the expectant mother was. For a while, she lay flat on the grass, panting. Then she got up and began grazing, still with those feet sticking out. "Really?" I said to her. "You can't go 5 minutes without eating?" Around her were other cows, all of whom seemed blind to her condition. "Do you think she knows there's a baby at the end of this?" I asked Maya after she'd returned. "A woman is told what's going to happen in the delivery room, but how does an animal interpret this pain?" I thought of the first time I had a kidney stone. That was in New York in 1991, back when I had no money or health insurance. All I knew was that I was hurting and couldn't afford to do anything about it. The night was spent moaning. Then I peed blood, followed by what looked like a piece of gravel from an aquarium. That's when I put it all together. What might I have thought if, after 7 hours of unrelenting agony, a creature the size of a full-grown cougar emerged inch by inch from the hole at the end of my penis and started hassling me for food? Was that what the cow was going through? Did she think she was dying, or had instinct somehow prepared her for this? Maya and I watched for an hour. Then the sun started to set, and we trekked on, disappointed. I left for London the next day, and when I returned several weeks later and hiked back to the field, I saw mother and child standing side by side, not in the loving way I had imagined, but more like strangers, waiting for the post office to open. Other animals I've seen on my walks are foxes and rabbits. I've stumbled upon deer, stoats, a hedgehog, and more pheasants than I could possibly count. All the badgers I find are dead, run over by cars, and eventually feasted upon by carrion-eating slugs, which are themselves eventually flattened and feasted upon by other slugs. Back when Maya and I saw the cow, I was averaging 25,000 steps, or around 10.5 miles per day. Trousers that had grown too snug were suddenly loose again, and I noticed that my face was looking a lot thinner. Then I upped it to 30,000 steps and started walking further afield. We saw David and Arundel picking up a dead squirrel with his grabbers, the neighbors told Hugh. We saw him outside of Stenning rolling a tire down the side of the road, in Pulborough dislodging a pair of Y-fronts from a tree branch. Before the Fitbit, once we'd eaten dinner, I was in for the evening. Now, though, as soon as I'm finished with the dishes, I walk to the pub and back, a distance of 3,895 steps. There are no streetlights where we live, and the houses I pass at 11 p.m. are either dark or very dimly lit. I'll often hear owls and the flapping of woodcocks, disturbed by the beam of my flashlight. One night, I heard a creaking sound and noticed that the minivan, parked a dozen or so steps ahead of me, was rocking back and forth. A lot of people where we live seem to have sex in their cars. I know this because I find their used condoms, sometimes on the road, but more often just off it in little pullover areas. In addition to spent condoms, in one of the spots that I patrol, I regularly pick up empty KFC containers and a great number of soiled handy wipes. Do they eat fried chicken and then have sex? Or is it the other way around, I wonder? I look back on the days I averaged only 30,000 steps and think, honestly, how lazy can you get? When I hit 35,000 steps a day, Fitbit sent me an e-badge, and then one for 40,000 and 45,000. Now I'm up to 60,000, which is 25.5 miles. Walking that distance at the age of 57 with completely flat feet while lugging a heavy bag of garbage takes close to 9 hours, a big block of time, but hardly wasted. I listen to audiobooks and podcasts. I talk to people. I learn things. The fact, for example, that in the days of yore, peppercorns were sold individually, and because they were so valuable, to guard against theft, the people who packed them had to have their pockets sewn shut. At the end of my first 60,000 step day, I staggered home with my flashlight, knowing that now I'd advanced to 65,000 and that there'd be no end to it until my feet snapped off at the ankles. Then it would just be my ragged bones stabbing into the soft ground. Why is it some people can manage a thing like a Fitbit while others go off the rails and allow it to rule and perhaps even ruin their lives? While marching along the roadside, I often think of a TV show that I watched a few years back. Obsessed, it was called. One of the episodes was devoted to a woman who owned 2 treadmills and walked like a hamster on a wheel from the moment she got up until she went to bed. Her family would eat dinner, and she'd observe them from her vantage point beside the table, panting as she asked her children about their day. I knew that I was supposed to scoff at this woman, to be, at the very least, entertainingly disgusted, the way I am with the people on Hoarders. But instead, I saw something of myself in her. Of course, she did her walking on a treadmill, where it served no greater purpose, so it's not like we're really that much alike, is it? In recognition of all the rubbish I've collected since getting my Fitbit, my local council is naming a garbage truck after me. The fellow in charge emailed to ask which font I'd like my name written in, and I answered, Roman. Get it? I said to you. Roman? He lost patience with me somewhere around the 35,000 mark and responded with a heavy sigh. Shortly after I decided on a typeface, for reasons I cannot determine, my Fitbit died. I was devastated when I tapped the broadest part of it and the little dots failed to appear. Then I felt a great sense of freedom. It seemed that my life was now my own again. But was it? Walking 25 miles or even running up the stairs and back suddenly seemed pointless, since without the steps being counted and registered, what use were they? I lasted 5 hours before I ordered a replacement, express delivery. It arrived the following afternoon, and my hands shook as I tore open the box. 10 minutes later, my new master strapped securely around my left wrist, I was out the door, racing, practically running, to make up for lost time. A House Divided. Because I'd accumulated so many miles, they bumped me to first class on the flight from Atlanta to Raleigh. I had assumed that our plane would be on the small side, but instead, owing to Thanksgiving and the great number of travelers, it was full size. I was seated in the second row, in front of a woman who looked to be in her early 60s and was letting her hair fade from dyed red to gray. After she settled in, she started a conversation with the fellow beside her. That's how I learned that she lived in Costa Rica. It's on account of my husband, she said. He's military, well, retired military, though you never really leave the Marine Corps, do you? She started explaining what had taken her from North Carolina to Central America, but then the flight attendant came to take a drink order from the guy next to me, and I missed it. Just as I was tuning back in, a man across the aisle tried to open his overhead bin. It was stuck for some reason, and he pounded on it, saying to anyone who would listen, "This is like Obamacare, broken." Several of the passengers around me laughed, and I noted their faces, vowing that in the event of a crisis, I would not help lead them to an emergency exit. "You people are on your own," I thought, knowing that if anything bad did happen, it would likely be one of them who'd saved me. It would be just my luck. I had passed judgment, so fate would force me to eat my words. After we took off from Atlanta, I pulled out my notebook, half making a list of things we'd need for Thanksgiving, and half listening to the woman behind me, who continued to talk throughout the entire flight. I guessed she was drinking, though I could have been wrong. Perhaps she was always this loud and adamant. "I never said I'd spend the rest of my life there. That's not what I meant at all." It was dark by the time we landed in Raleigh, and as we taxied to the gate, one of the flight attendants made an announcement. The "remain seated until the fasten seatbelt sign has been turned off" part was to be expected. But then she added that we had some very special passengers on board. "Oh, no," I thought. "Please don't embarrass me." I was just wondering who the other important person might be when she said, "With us today is the outstanding soccer team from," she named a high school in the Triangle area and concluded with, "Let's give them all a great big hand." The woman behind me whooped and cheered, and when no one joined her, she raised her voice shouting, "You people are assholes. I mean, what the hell? You can't even applaud for your own teenagers?" I meant to, but figured the team was back in coach. They wouldn't have heard me one way or the other, so what difference did it make? "Pathetic," the woman spat. "Too wrapped up in your smartphones and iPads to congratulate a group of high school athletes." You couldn't say she hadn't nailed us. Still, I had to bite my hand to keep from laughing. It's so funny to be called an asshole by someone who doesn't know you, but then again, knows you so perfectly. "See that woman?" I said to Hugh when he met me at the baggage claim a few minutes later. I told him what had happened on the plane, and he folded his arms across his chest the way he always does before lecturing me. "She was right, you know. You should have applauded." "We've been apart for 2 months," I reminded him. "Would it kill you to take my side in this?" He apologized, but after I'd wrestled my bag off the carousel and we'd started toward the parking lot, he added, quietly, but not so quietly that I couldn't hear him, "You really should have clapped." From the airport, we drove to my brother Paul's. There we met up with my sister Gretchen, who had a cast on her right forearm and held it aloft, like someone perpetually being sworn in. "It helps ease the pain," she explained. I hadn't seen Gretchen since the previous spring and was startled by her appearance. For as long as I could remember, she'd worn her hair long, and though it still fell to below her shoulder blades in the back, the top was now cropped and stood from the crown of her head like the fur of a graying German shepherd. Odder still, she had a sun visor on. "Since when have you had this mullet?" I asked. Only when she lifted it off did I realize she was wearing a cap, the sort sold in joke shops. "The hair is attached to the top of it, see? I got it at the beach last month." I hadn't been to our house on Emerald Isle, the C-section, since we'd bought it 5 months earlier, though Hugh had. He'd flown over in late September to start making improvements. Gretchen joined him for a few days shortly before Halloween and fell into a rut while walking on the beach. That's how she broke her arm. "Can you believe it?" she asked. "No one has worse luck than me." When there's no traffic, it's a 2.5-hour drive from Raleigh to Emerald Isle. We left at around 8 p.m., and on the way, I asked Gretchen about her job. She works as a horticulturalist for the city of Raleigh and had recently discovered a campsite in one of its larger parks. That's common enough, but this one was occupied by someone we once knew. His name was familiar, but I couldn't picture his face until Gretchen put him in context. He used to come over to the house and hang out with Mom. "Oh, right," I said. "Do Kids like to believe that their parents will get lonely after they leave the house, but I think my mother actually did. She delighted in her children and always enjoyed talking to our friends and the people we were going out with. "Why don't you invite Jeff to dinner?" I remember her asking Gretchen one night in the late 70s. Because we broke up a month ago and I've been in my room crying ever since. "Well, he still needs to eat," my mother said. The fellow who wound up living in a city park, Kevin, I'll call him, started dropping by in the early 80s. His parents and mine owned some rental property together, and over the years both he and I performed odd jobs there. I remembered him as directionless and guessed from what my sister told me that he pretty much stayed that way. Still, it seemed incredible to me that something like this could happen. For we were middle class, and I'd been raised to believe that our social status inoculated us against severe misfortune. A person might be broke from time to time, who wasn't? But you could never be poor the way that actual poor people were. Poor with lice and missing teeth, your genes would reject it. Slip too far beneath the surface, and wouldn't your family resuscitate you with a loan or rehab or whatever it was you needed to get back on your feet? Then there'd be friends, hopefully ones who went to college and might at the very least view you as a project, the thing they'd renovate after the kitchen was finished. At what point had I realized that class couldn't save you, that addiction or mental illness didn't care whether you'd taken piano lessons or spent a summer in Europe? Which drunk or junkie or unmedicated schizophrenic was I crossing the street to avoid when I put it all together? I didn't know what the story was with Kevin. The two of us had had every advantage, yet now he was living in a thicket 3 miles from the house he grew up in. My siblings and I used to worry that once our father was gone, a similar fate might befall our sister Tiffany, who had committed suicide 6 months earlier. Like all of us, she received an inheritance a few years after our mother died. It wasn't a fortune, but it was certainly more than I had ever seen. The money arrived just after I really needed it, at a moment when, for the first time in my adult life, I was finally on my feet. I paid off my student loan with a portion of it. My father wanted me to invest the rest, but I didn't want the idea of money. I wanted the real thing. So I parked it in my checking account and would go to an ATM sometimes twice a day just to look at my balance on the screen. A year earlier, the most I'd had was $100. Now, this. It was interesting to see what we all did with our inheritance. Pragmatic Lisa put her check in the bank. Gretchen moved south and saw to some bills, while Amy and Paul essentially spent their money on candy. Tiffany was the only one who quit her job, thinking, I guess, that she was set. Within 2 years, she was broke, but rather than rejoining the workforce, she decided that money was evil, as were most of the people who had it. She canceled her checking account and started bartering, exchanging a day's work for a carton of cigarettes or a bag of groceries. At night, she'd go through people's trash cans, looking for things she could sell. It's like she saw poverty as an accomplishment. I'll be out at 1 in the morning, knee-deep in a dumpster, and elbowing aside some immigrant Haitian lady for the good stuff, she boasted once when I visited her in Somerville. Maybe the Haitian woman has to be there, I said. She has nothing at her disposal while you have an education. You had braces on your teeth. You speak good English. My argument was an old and stodgy one. The best thing you can do for the poor is avoid joining their ranks, thus competing with them for limited goods and services. On that same visit, Tiffany explained that poor people refuse to answer surveys. When census takers come to our doors, we ignore them. She spoke the way a tribal leader might to a visiting anthropologist. We Pawnees grind our corn with a rock. Every time I visited, her apartment was more of a wreck. Not just messy, but filthy. How can you live like this? I asked the last time I was there. We poor people don't have the energy to clean up after ourselves, she told me. After she was evicted, she lived in a series of single rooms with people just as badly off as herself. According to Tiffany, the only thing wrong with her was her back. That's why, at the age of 43, she went on disability, she said. Since when, though, do they prescribe lithium and clonopin for back pain? If she'd been more forthright, we could have put her behavior in context, could have said, when she tested our patients, that's her illness talking. As it was, it didn't add up. Why can't a grown woman hold a job, we wondered? Why does she have so many restraining orders against people? Tiffany would have inherited money from our father someday, though she likely would have burned right through it. You want a car? She'd have said, perhaps to someone she met in a parking lot. I'll buy you a fucking Bronco or whatever. Is that what you want? Word would have gotten out that some lady was buying people Broncos, and in no time she'd have been penniless again and feeling just fine about it. An hour before arriving at the beach, Hugh stopped at a fast food place called Hardee's so I could get a coffee. The town we were in was small and grim, and the restaurant was deserted except for us. Inside the front door stood a Christmas tree, over-decorated in a majestic combination of red and gold. "How long has this been up?" I asked the woman behind the counter. She scratched at the tattoos on her left forearm, initials that looked like they'd been done at home with a sewing needle. "Since last Tuesday, maybe?" She turned to the fellow cleaning the grill. "Did that sound right?"
"Just about," he said.
"Will you have a tree at home?" I asked. "Have you put it up yet?" This is the sort of thing that drives Hugh crazy. What does it matter if her Christmas tree is up? But there was no one in line behind me, and I was genuinely curious.
"I think it's too early," the woman said. "My kids is all excited for one, but we ain't even had Thanksgiving yet."
Gretchen ran her good hand over the false hair on top of her head. "Will you cook a turkey on Thanksgiving or go with something else?" "Are you too happy now?" Hugh asked when we finally returned to the car. "Need to go back in and learn what everyone's doing for New Year's, or do you think we can leave?" Gretchen propped up her broken arm on the narrow window ledge. "If he thinks we're bad, he should spend more time with Lisa." "That's true," I agreed. "Lisa's the master. I left her at a Starbucks for 90 seconds last year, and when I returned, the woman behind the counter was saying to her, 'My gynecologist told me that exact same thing.'" I normally don't believe in drinking coffee in the car. Most often I spill more than I swallow. But without it, I'd have fallen asleep and then had to revive myself once we reached the house. It was after 11 when we arrived, and I was pleasantly surprised by all the changes. The place we bought is 2 stories tall and divided down the middle into equal-sized units. You can pass back and forth between one half and the other by way of a hotel-style connecting door in the living room, but it's inconvenient if you're upstairs. The 2 kitchens are another problem, as we really only need one. Our initial idea was to knock down some walls and transform it into a single 6-bedroom home. Then I recalled our last trip to the beach and the number of times I found my brother lying on the sofa with his shoes on, and decided that 2 separate halves was probably a good idea. The left side, which was softly lit and decorated with carefully chosen mid-century furniture, was mine and Hugh's, while the junky right side was for everyone else. Of course, other people could stay in our half, but only when we were there to monitor and scold them. Because everyone was coming for Thanksgiving, the house was going to be full. The family was arriving in dribs and drabs, so for the first night, it was just the 3 of us. On the 2nd day, late in the afternoon, Lisa pulled up. I helped her unload her car, and then we took a walk on the beach. It was cold enough to see our breath, and a strong wind was blowing. "Did I tell you I got Tiffany's toxicology report?" she asked a while after we'd left the house. "They also sent me her death certificate, and apparently..." At that moment, a Labrador retriever bounded up, tail wagging, a middle-aged woman in a baseball cap trotting behind it. "Brandy, no," she scolded, adding as she unfurled her leash, "I'm sorry."
"For what?"
Lisa gathered the dog's head in her hand. "You're beautiful, aren't you?" she trilled in the melodic voice she uses for things with tails. "Yes, you are, and you know it," she turned to the owner. "How old is she?"
2 years this February," the woman said.
"I have one that age," Lisa told her, "and she's a real handful." I have no patience for this kind of talk and turned to face the ocean, waiting for the conversation to end. Hopefully then I could learn what our sister had used to kill herself with. We figured she had taken pills, Klonopin most likely. And though it technically didn't matter if she'd mixed it with other things, we still wanted to know. Behind me, Lisa was telling the strange woman that the Newfoundland water dog she had before the one she has now died after swallowing all her husband Bob's high blood pressure medication. My God, the woman said, that must have been awful. Oh, it was, Lisa told her. We just felt so guilty. The woman with the Labrador wished us a happy Thanksgiving, and as she headed down the beach, Lisa continued her story. So they sent me the death certificate, and the cause isn't listed as a drug overdose, but as asphyxiation. I don't get it, I said. She sniffed her hands for dog and then stuffed them into her coat pockets. After taking the Klonopin, Tiffany put a plastic bag over her head. Lisa paused a moment to let that sink in. I wrote to the state trooper who found her body and sent him a picture of her in her 20s, the pretty one we ran with her obituary. I just wanted him to know she was more than what he walked in on. I've always liked to think that before killing myself, I take the time to really mess with people. By this I mean that I'd leave them things and write letters, nice ones, apologizing for my actions and reassuring them that there was nothing they could have said or done to change my mind. In the fantasy, I'd leave money to those who'd have never expected it. Who's he? They'd wonder after opening the envelope. It might be a Polish lifeguard at the pool I used to go to in London, or a cashier I was quietly fond of. Only lately do I realize how ridiculous this is. When you're in the state that my sister was in, and that most people are in when they take their own lives, you're not thinking of anything beyond your own pain. Thus, the plastic bag. The maximizer, as it were. The thing a person reaches for after their first attempt at an overdose fails and they wake up sick a day later thinking, I can't even kill myself right. It's hard to find a bag without writing on it. The name of a store, most often. Lowe's, it might read. Safeway. True Value. Does a person go through a number of them before making a selection, or, as I suspect, will any bag do, regardless of the ironic statement it might make? This is what was going through my mind when Lisa stopped walking and turned to me, asking, "Will you do me a favor?" "Anything," I said, just so grateful to have her alive and beside me. She held out her foot. "Will you tie my shoe?" "Well, sure," I said, "but can you tell me why?" She sighed. "My pants are tight and I don't feel like bending over." I knelt down into the damp sand and did as she'd asked. It was almost dark, and as I stood back up, I looked at the long line of houses stretching to the pier. One of them belonged to us, but I couldn't have begun to guess which one it was. Judging by distance was no help either, as I had no idea how long we'd been walking. Lisa hadn't spent any more time at the C-section than I had, so she wasn't much help. "Does our place have one deck or two?" she asked. "Two," I said. "Unless it has only one?" The houses before us were far from identical. They were painted every color you could think of, yet in the weak light, reduced to basic shapes, their resemblance was striking. All were wooden with prominent picture windows, all had staircases leading to the beach, and all had the air of a second home, one devoted to leisure rather than struggle. They likely didn't contain many file cabinets, but if you were after puzzles or golf clubs or board games, you'd come to the right place. The people in the houses looked similar as well. We could see them in their kitchens and family rooms, watching TV or standing before open refrigerators. They were white, for the most part, and conservative, the sort of people we'd grown up with at the country club, the kind who'd have sat in the front of the plane and laughed when the man across the aisle compared his broken overhead bin to Obamacare. That said, we could have knocked on any of these doors, explained our situation, and received help. "These folks have a house, but don't know which one it is," I could imagine a homeowner shouting over his shoulder into the next room. "Remember when that happened to us?" It's silly, but after a while I started to panic, thinking, I guess, that we could die out there, in the cold, looking for one of my houses. I was just condemning Lisa for not bringing her phone when I spotted the broken fishing rod tied to our railing. I'd noticed it earlier that day and had made a mental note to remove it. Paul put it there so he'd be able to tell which house was ours, Gretchen had told me. I'd said, well, we'll see about that. Now, here I was, seeing about it. Hugh was in the kitchen on our side of the house making soup when we walked in. We got lost, Lisa told him. Were you worried about us? He dried his hands on his apron and tried to pretend he'd known we were out. Was I ever? The air smelled pleasantly of chicken stock and onions. On the radio, it was announced that the president would be pardoning a turkey and that its name was Popcorn. That's nice, Lisa said. While she went to her room to change, I walked through the connecting door and into the second kitchen. There I found Gretchen standing at the counter before a bowl of sliced apples. Did Lisa by any chance tell you about Tiffany? I asked. The plastic bag, you mean? Gretchen nodded. She told me on the phone last week. I try not to think of it, but it's pretty much all I can think about. Our own sister, ending up that way. I walked to the window and looked at the sky, which had now gone from bruise-colored to black. Someone told me, I said, that in Japan, if you commit suicide by throwing yourself in front of a train, your family gets fined the equivalent of $80,000 for all the inconvenience you caused. From behind me, I could hear Gretchen slicing more apples. Of course, I continued, if your family was the whole reason you were killing yourself, I suppose it would just be an added incentive. Out on the beach, I could see the beam of a flashlight skittering across the sand. Someone was walking past the house, maybe to their own place, or perhaps to one they were renting for the long holiday weekend. If it was smaller than the C-section, or less well-positioned, they maybe looked up into our gaily lit windows and resented us, wondering, as we often did ourselves these days, what we had done to deserve all this. The perfect fit. I'm not sure how it is in small families, but in large ones, relationships tend to shift over time. You might be best friends with one brother or sister, then 2 years later, it might be someone else. Then it's likely to change again and again after that. It doesn't mean that you've fallen out with the person you used to be closest to, but that you've merged into someone else's lane, or had him or her merge into yours. Trios form, then morph into quartets before splitting into teams of two. The beauty of it is that it's always changing. Twice in 2014, I went to Tokyo with my sister Amy. I'd been 7 times already, so was able to lead her to all the best places, by which I mean stores. When we returned in January 2016, it made sense to bring our sister Gretchen with us. Hugh was there as well. And while he's a definite presence, he didn't figure into the family dynamic. Mates to my sisters and me are seen mainly as shadows of the people they're involved with. They move, they're visible in direct sunlight. But because they don't have access to our emotional buttons, because they can't make us 12 again, or 5, and screaming, they really don't count as players. Normally in Tokyo we rent an apartment and stay for a week. This time, though, we got a whole house. The neighborhood it was in, Ebisu, is home to one of our favorite shops, Capital. The clothes they sell are new but appear to have been previously worn, perhaps by someone who was shot or stabbed, and then thrown off a boat. Everything looks as if it had been pulled from the evidence rack at a murder trial. I don't know how they do it. Most distressed clothing seems obviously fake, but not theirs for some reason.
Do they put it in a dryer with broken glass and rusty steak knives? Do they drag it behind a tank over a still smoldering battlefield? How do they get the cuts and stains so right? If I had to use one word to describe Capital's clothing, I'd be torn between wrong and tragic. A shirt might look normal enough until you try it on and discover that the armholes have been moved and are no longer level with your shoulders like a capital T, but further down your torso, like a lowercase one. Jackets with patches on them might senselessly bunch at your left hip, or maybe they poof out at the small of your back where for no good reason there's a pocket. I've yet to see a pair of Capital trousers with a single leg hole, but that doesn't mean the designers haven't already done it. Their motto seems to be, why not? Most people would answer, I'll tell you, why not? But I like Capital's philosophy. I like their clothing as well, though I can't say that it always likes me in return. I'm not narrow enough in the chest for most of their jackets, but what was to stop me on this most recent trip from buying a flannel shirt made of 5 differently patterned flannel shirts, ripped apart, and then stitched together into a kind of doleful Franken-top? I got hats as well, 3 of them, which I like to wear stacked up, all at the same time, partly just to get it over with, but mainly because I think they look good as a tower. I draw the line at clothing with writing on it, but numbers don't bother me, so I also bought a tattered long-sleeve T-shirt with 99 cut from white fabric and stitched onto the front before being half burned off. It's as though a football team's plane had gone down, and this was all that was left. Finally, I bought what might be called a tunic, made of denim and patched at the neck with defeated scraps of corduroy. When buttoned, the front flares out, making me look like I have a pot belly. These are clothes that absolutely refuse to flatter you. They go out of their way to insult you, really, and still my sisters and I can't get enough. There are 3 Capital stores in Ebisu, and their interior design is as off-putting as their merchandise. Most clothing hangs from the ceiling, though there are a few beaten-up racks and horizontal surfaces that items are strewn across. At one of the shops, the window display consisted of 3 carved penises, arranged from small to large. The most modest was on par with a Coleman thermos, while the king-size one was as long and thick as a wrestler's forearm. Amy's eyes popped out of her head. Before I could stop her, she hoisted the middle one out of the window, crying, "Oh my goodness, it's teak! I thought from out on the sidewalk that it was mahogany." As if she were a wood expert and saw nothing beyond the grain. The salesman blinked as Amy turned the dildo upside down. Then she positioned her right hand at the base of the testicles and pretended she was a waitress. Would anyone care for some freshly ground pepper? There are 3 other branches of Capital in Tokyo, and we visited them all and stayed in each one until our fingerprints were on everything. "My God," Gretchen said, trying on a hat that seemed to have been modeled after a used toilet brush and adding it to her pile. "This place is amazing. I had no idea." The main reason we asked Gretchen to join us is that she understands shopping. That is to say, she understands there is nothing but shopping. Unlike our brother Paul or our sister Lisa, whose disinterest in buying things is downright masculine, she and her husband Bob don't exchange Christmas gifts, but will rather go in on something, a new set of shelves for the laundry room, for instance, or a dehumidifier. They usually buy whatever it is in midsummer, so by December it's been forgotten. It's the same with their anniversary and birthdays. Nothing. "But you can change that," I often tell her. "Right," she says, the way I do when someone suggests I learn how to drive. And it's not just big-ticket items. She and I were at O'Hare Airport one afternoon and passed a place that sold nuts. "Why don't you get some for Bob?" I asked. "There would be a nice little something to bring him as a gift." She looked at the stand, a cart really, and frowned. "I would, but his dentist told him he has brittle teeth." "He doesn't have to crack them open in his mouth," I said. Everything here is pre-shelled.
That's okay.
I would never leave town and not bring Hugh back a gift, nor would he do that to me, though in truth I had to train him. He's normally not that much of a shopper, but Tokyo seems to knock something loose in him. Perhaps it's because it's so far away. The difference is that he's ashamed of it. I think it's something he gets from his mother, who considers shopping to be wasteful, or, worse still in her book, unserious. "Why go to a store when you could go to a museum?" she might ask.
Because the museum doesn't sell shit?
My sisters and I refuse to feel bad about shopping, and why should we? Obviously we have some hole we're trying to fill, but doesn't everyone? And isn't filling it with berets the size of toilet seat covers, if not more practical, then at least healthier than filling it with frosting or heroin or unsafe sex with strangers? Besides, Amy said at the dinner table on the first night of our vacation, it's not like everything we buy is for ourselves. I'll be getting birthday presents for friends and all sorts of things for my godson.
You don't have to convince me, I told her, as we're cut from the same cloth.
Shopping has nothing to do with money. If you have it, you go to stores and galleries, and if not, you haunt flea markets or Goodwills. Never, though, do you not do it, choosing instead to visit a park or a temple or some cultural institution where they don't sell things. Our sister-in-law Kathy swears by eBay, but I like the social aspect of shopping, getting out, touching things, and talking to people. I work at home, so most days the only contact I have, except for Hugh, is with salespeople and cashiers. My problem is that if someone really engages me or goes the slightest bit out of his way, I feel I have to buy whatever it is he's selling, especially if it involves a ladder or a set of keys. That explains the small painting of a forsaken shack I bought on the fourth day of our vacation at a place I like called On Sundays. It's on an odd-shaped scrap of plywood, and though it's by a contemporary artist I've always gotten a kick out of, an American named Barry McGee, and was probably a very fair price, I bought it mainly because the store manager unlocked the case that it was in.
"I would have got it if you hadn't, Amy," my enabler said, as I left with the painting and a recently purchased, very pricey tote bag that had cowboys on it.
Then it was on to another of our favorite places, the Tokyo outpost of the Dover Street Market. The original store in London sells both clothing and the kind of objects you might find in a natural history museum. I got the inner ear of a whale there a few years back, and a four-horned antelope skull that was found in India in 1890. The Ginza branch sticks to clothing and accessories. I'd gone with Amy on our first trip together in 2014 and left with a pair of wide-legged, Paul Harden trousers that come up to my nipples. The button-down fly is a foot long, and when I root around in my pockets for change, my forearms disappear all the way to the elbows. You can't belt something that reaches that high up on your torso, thus the suspenders, which came with the trousers and are beautiful, but still, suspenders. Clown pants is what they are, artfully hand-stitched, lined all the way to the ankle, but clown pants all the same. They cost as much as a MacBook Air, and I'd have walked away from them were it not for Amy saying, "Are you kidding? You have to get those." This time, I bought a pair of blue and white polka-dot culottes. Hugh hates this sort of thing and accuses me of transitioning. "They're just shorts," I tell him. "Bell-bottom shorts, but shorts all the same. How is that womanly?" A year and a half earlier, at the same Dover Street Market, I bought a pair of heavy black culottes, dress culottes, you could call them, made by Comme des Garçons and also beautifully lined. They made a pleasant whooshing sound as I ran up the stairs of my house, searching in vain for whatever shoes a grown man might wear with them. Hugh disapproved, but again, I thought I looked great, much better than I do in regular trousers. "My calves are my one good feature," I reminded him as he gritted his teeth. "Why can't I highlight them every now and then?"
The dress culottes weren't as expensive as the pants that come up to my nipples, but still they were extravagant. I buy a lot of what I think of as at-home clothes, things I'd wear at my desk or when lying around at night after a bath, but never outdoors. These troubling Jiminy Cricket-style trousers, for instance, that I bought at another of my favorite Japanese stores, 45 RPM. They have horizontal stripes and make my ass look like a half a dozen coins collected in a sack made from an old prison uniform. I'd have felt like a fool paying all that money and limiting my nipple-high pants and black dress culottes to home, so I started wearing them on stage, which still left me feeling like a fool, but a different kind of one. "I hate to tell you," a woman said after a show one night, "but those culottes look terrible on you." I was shattered. "Really? They're way too long," she told me. And so I had them shortened, then shortened again, at which point they no longer made the pleasant mushing sound and were ruined. "Are these too long for me?" I asked the saleswoman on our most recent trip. "Not at all," I'm pretty sure she told me. A few days later, at the big Comme des Garçons shop in Omotesando, I bought yet another pair of culottes, a fancier pair that are cerulean blue. "What are you doing?" Hugh moaned as I stepped out of the dressing room. "That's three pairs of culottes you'll own now." All I could say in my defense was, "Maybe I have a busy life." I then tried on a button-down shirt that was made to be worn backward. The front was plain and almost suggested a straitjacket. You'd have to have someone close you into it, and, of course, not your tie if you were going for a more formal look. I'd have bought it were it not too tight at the neck. "Maybe it will fit you after you have your Adam's apple shaved off," Hugh said. Amy loaded up at Comme des Garçons as well, buying, among other things, a skirt that looks to have been made from the insides of suit pockets. "What just happened?" she asked as we left the store considerably more broke and went up a few doors to Yoji Yamamoto, where I bought what Hugh calls a dress, but what is most certainly a smock, a denim one that has side pockets. The front closes with snaps, and, for whatever reason, the back does as well. Most days we returned to our rental house, groaning beneath the weight of our purchases, things I'd often wind up regretting the moment I pulled them out of their bags. A pair of drawstring jeans, two sizes too large, for instance. Drawstring jeans. Or a wool shirt that was relatively sober and would have been great were I able to wear wool. As it is, it causes me to itch and sweat something awful. "Then why did you get it?" Hugh asked. "Because everybody else got something," I told him, adding that it was on sale and I could always send it to my father, who might not wear it but would undoubtedly appreciate the gesture. Shopping with my sisters in Japan was like being in a pie-eating contest, only with stuff. We often felt sick, dazed, bloated, vulgar, yet never quite ashamed. "I think I need to lie down," I said one evening, "maybe with that brand new $80 washcloth on my forehead." Nothing was a total waste, I reasoned, as paying for it gave me a chance to practice my Japanese. "I am buying something now," I'd say as I approached the register. "I have money. I have coins, too." As if he or she had been handed a script, the cashier would ask where I was from and what I was doing in Tokyo. "I am American," I would say, "but now I live in England. I am on vacation with my sisters." "Oh, your sisters." Then I started saying, "I am a doctor." "What kind?" asked a woman who sold me a bandana with pictures of fruit and people having sex on it. "A children's doctor," I said. I wouldn't set out to misrepresent myself, but I didn't know the words for author or trash collector. Doctor, though, was in one of the 90 teach-yourself Japanese lessons I'd reviewed before leaving England. I loved the respect being a pediatrician brought me in Japan. Even when I wore a smock and had a tower of three hats on my head, you could see it in people's faces. I grew before their very eyes. "Did you just tell that lady you're a doctor?" Amy would ask.
"A little," I'd say.
A week after leaving Tokyo, I was on a flight from Hobart, Tasmania, to Melbourne. And when a passenger got sick and the flight attendant asked if there was a physician on board, my hand was halfway to the call button before I remembered that I am not, in fact, a doctor, that I just play one in Japan. Though it cut into our shopping time, one thing we all looked forward to in Tokyo was lunch, which was always eaten out, usually at some place we just chanced upon. One afternoon toward the end of our vacation, settling into my seat at a tempura restaurant in Shibuya, I looked across the table at Amy, who was wearing a varsity sweater from Capital that appeared to have bloodstains and bits of brain on it, and at Gretchen with her toilet brush hat. I was debuting a shirt that fell 3 inches below my knees. It was black and made me look like a hand puppet. "We don't have the same eyes or noses, my sisters and I. Our hairlines are different, and the shapes of our faces, but on this particular afternoon the family resemblance was striking. Anyone could tell that we were related, even someone from another planet who believed that humans were as indistinguishable from one another as acorns. At this particular moment of our lives, no one belonged together more than us. Who would have thought when we were children that the three of us would wind up here, in Japan of all places, dressed so expensively like mental patients and getting along so well together? It's a thought we all had several times a day. Look at how our lives turned out. What a surprise. When the menus came, Gretchen examined hers upside down. She had never used chopsticks before coming to Tokyo, and for the first few days she employed them separately, one in each hand, like daggers. Amy was a little better, but when it came to things like rice, she tended to give up and just